Father, for that kind introduction. I hope that I can give some idea of how it is that someone with my background in education, one that popular wisdom would have us believe would lead one away from religious faith, actually had the opposite effect. And it was through my scientific education and medical education and influential professors that I encountered that I eventually came to embrace not only the Catholic faith, but the traditional Catholic faith, which is presented as even more opposed than anything else to scientific reason and scientific truth. During the midst of the council and the promises of a new springtime, I was born in a Sisters of Charity hospital and baptized in a church built by Leonard Giblin Sr., my grandfather, and dedicated to the Immaculate Conception. And so as I came of age and began my religious education, vast changes were already in the works. And so the education that I received was more of one in which was taught of the things that were going to be changing. I remember early on there were quite a few religious, and for a small town, there was a big religious community with the Sisters of Charity there in Port Arthur, Texas. But they very quickly began to disappear, and the laity began to take over religious education. And I recall some of the pious laity, like my godmother, the sense of loss that they had and dejection. And it was very disturbing to see. But I still had quite an interest in the church, and I was very, very interested in the Mass. I was really drawn to the Mass. Something seemed to be very, very important. The whole community gathered together. There was ritual. Something seemed to be critical about the Mass for everyone's life. And so I signed up to be an altar boy, and but I was never called. Never called for the instruction, never called to serve, so I began to pester my mother, and continuously pestering, and then she would pester the priest, and then finally I was told, show up at 5:30 every morning, and you can serve for Mass before you go to school. So even from a young age, I had a habit of hiding in my closet with the light on so I could read, very still important enough to me to get up that early and serve Mass. And when I first arrived to serve, I mentioned to the priest that I hadn't had any instruction. I had no idea what to do. I hadn't a clue. And he said it didn't matter. When he signaled, just bring in the water and wine, and that's all that was necessary. So, all right, so I did that. I showed up regularly every morning to serve Mass, tired as I was, because it seemed important to me. And then I learned how to serve just by watching the other altar boys, and especially on Sunday, learned when to ring the bells and just by watching them. But then as things started to change, the cassock started changing, and even though none of the altar boys wanted to wear the new polyester pullover cassocks and would wear the traditional ones, the traditional cassocks just ended up disappearing, and so we had no choice. And then also the bells started to disappear into ever more difficult places to find them. And basically all elements of the traditional Mass were just disappearing right before my eyes. But then there was one moment that I always remember. And it was when I was sitting up on the altar, or where the altar used to stand, sitting in the gospel's place of honor with the priest in the middle and the other altar boy on the other side. And I looked out and I felt an immense sense of pride, because here I was, everyone with their eyes on us. Obviously, we were important, we were special, and I just remember this incredible sense of pride of how special I must be. And that turned to a horrible sense of foreboding and disgust, because why? Why should I be special? I wasn't doing anything, I was just sitting up there. Why should I feel so special? And there was no reason. It just seemed like a horrible farce. And it just sickened me so much that I refused to have anything to do with serving Mass and informed my parents of it and said, I won't have anything to do with it anymore. But I still continued to go to Mass with them as they demanded, and watched as the notorious public sinners, well known in such a small town, invaded the sanctuary with their guitars and their insipid pop songs, full of that same pride that I saw in myself when I was up on where the altar used to be. And it just cemented in my mind, especially with my parents' reaction to this, that Catholicism was just some monstrous fraud, and I didn't want to have anything to do with it. It seemed so dishonest and so insincere, and it just seemed as something that I just wanted nothing to do with whatsoever. And so I abandoned all interest in religion at that point. And perhaps, I mean, there are graces, that indelible graces at baptism, but besides that, if I have had a saving grace, it was that I also had a very strong childhood interest in mechanics and how things work. It just fascinated me. And being in, growing up in such a small blue-collar town, there were so many people that were working on mechanical things, motorcycles and mini bikes, which fascinated me. And so I would always want to watch and want to learn, and they would show me and teach me. But there was one question that I always asked, one question that interests me above all others, besides just the intellectual satisfaction of solving problems and learning how to do that. And that question was, how did you know that's what you needed to fix? How did you know that was wrong? Is the epistemological question, how do we come to know the truth? And that has always fascinated me from that time. And that is really what led to my interest in, my philosophical interest in science and in medicine, besides, again, the intellectual satisfaction, just trying to get to this philosophical question, how do we come to know the truth? My father did provide one important clue. During all the changes and when the lay teachers who had replaced the religious that had been teaching CCD before, when they were telling all the things that were going to change and how they were going to change, I asked my father, I said, all these things are going to change. What's taken the church so long? And he said, those things can't change. I said, why not? He said, because the truth doesn't change. And that, for me, was a critical philosophical concept. And that's really the basis of all science, because there's no use in doing science if the truth changes. Science has that metaphysical foundation that the truth is unchanging and that we can come to know the truth, even though it's a process where we can come closer to the truth or we move back from the truth. But the truth
is unchanging and therefore it is knowable, but what is the process whereby we can get closer to the truth? So continued on in my education, with my skills and problem solving, learned from my mechanical interests, science was quite natural. But in secondary school, the way science is taught, there's not really a teaching of how science is done, but it's taught by, okay, here's the laws, here's how it works, and you just learn that process, you learn that technique. But the philosophical elements are not taught. That didn't come until graduate education that I began to learn those. And the real eye-opener there was when I took this course in college called Life Through Time. And this was a course on evolution, and the intention was to begin with chemical evolution. How did the basic molecules of living things come into being from completely sterile and dead planet? And then how did those evolve into living things and then ever more complex organisms? And the professor teaching this course was a renowned paleontologist, Dr. Ernie Lundelius. And Dr. Lundelius began his introduction to the course by saying that he was going to present some things as facts, and he was going to present some theories as true. But this was a course in science, so we needed to understand that some of these facts that he's presenting and some of these theories are going to be wrong. And he didn't know how much of them were wrong or which ones were wrong. So part of the scientific process was for us to question and for us to try to find the errors, help him find his errors. And that was an attitude that was... had not come across as a part of science. Science had always been taught, this is it, this is the facts, you believe it, or you hate the truth. And so that was a crucial moment for me, because here, this professor, in teaching a course on evolution, no less, had delivered or given me the hermeneutical key to the epistemological question of how we know the truth, and it's humility, only through humility. And so that had a profound effect on me. And it also, being a true believer in evolution at that time, it also really opened my eyes, because he went through every pillar of evolution and completely disproved it. And it's not because he was anti-evolution or because he had some religious objection or anything else. He was just an honest scientist. He wanted to know the truth above all else and recognized that the greatest obstacle to knowing the truth is our own biases, our own prejudices. And so that led me to come to some philosophical insights that I ended up becoming a preacher of sorts. And I would preach that we have two competing desires. We want to know the truth, but we also want to force the truth to bend to our wills. We want to define the truth. We want to force the truth to fit our own fallen wills. And it's very rare that our love for the truth would win out over our selfish desire to force the truth to be what we want it to be. And when that happens, when there's a conflict between our will, our fallen will, and the truth, well, we'll ignore it. If that doesn't work, then we'll try to humiliate it. If that doesn't work, well, we'll scourge it and we'll crucify it. And so I was preaching this, considering myself an agnostic, if not atheist. This seemed to be the key to me, that the real meaning, the real purpose of my life was to love the truth above all else. So then I continued with my higher education, because after that moment, as an undergraduate, I knew that philosophically I wanted to pursue science, because this was the first time that I'd ever encountered that kind of humility. And also in science, science has been able to assert that it has some knowledge of the truth and back it up. So I thought, well, this is it. This is how you get there. Science will provide the philosophical foundation to really answer this question that I've always had of how do we get to know the truth and how do we get closer to it. So I took up an education, a higher education. I was quite lucky to be able to pursue both medicine and a PhD at the same time through a combined degree program. And so I was able to see it both in medical science and in biophysics to pursue this philosophical interest. And of course, the intellectual satisfaction of using the skills that I've been developing since childhood to help others and to do some good, that was part of it too. But the real draw was this philosophical fascination that I had with epistemology. And so as I'm studying biophysics, which one would think that's about the most dry science, one of the most dry sciences you could pursue, there's not going to be much bias. And I guess I was quite, kind of naive, because I thought, oh, I'll pursue science. There's not going to be much politics in science. Boy, was I ever wrong about that. And so I thought, well, this will be something where I can really sink my teeth into. And so I started in Galveston at a well-respected program, biophysics program. They did a lot of the physiology of man in space for NASA, and it was a renowned program. And they had that same attitude that I encountered in this paleontology professor. And so I really was excited and felt at home. And I recall this one professor, Dr. Fishman, he was lamenting and complaining about the biophysics literature. Now, Dr. Fishman was an electrical engineer before taking up biophysics. And so he intimately understood the electronic apparatus used for doing the experiments, for making the measurements. And so he knew what was going on with every electron in the devices. And that's what biophysics does a lot, is to measure the fluxes of movements of ions in and out of cells and that type of thing. And he was complaining that most of the biophysics literature is bogus. He said it's just completely bogus. Actually, he used more colorful words that would more accurately express his lamentations, but he said they're just completely off. And that's why, he said, because now researchers can buy the equipment without really understanding how it works. And then all they have to do is turn the knobs until they get the results that they want, and then they publish it. And so it's totally bogus. All they've done is just adjust the knobs to get the results they want. They don't really understand what's going on. And so he really brought out the what I was hoping to hear and what I had gone there for and to put myself through, which is we have this incredible bias, even when you're trying to do something as apparently as objective as biophysics, and it's very difficult to overcome. To mention another evolutionist, Stephen Jay Gould, who is a prominent, has been a prominent popularizer of evolution, he wrote a book called Life, The Mismeasure of Man. And in this book, he documents and goes through how to support racial theories of racial superiority and those types of things, that researchers that were making measurements, say, of cranial capacity, the size of the brain between different races, how the results were skewed by their bias. And a real important point of that is that they didn't even intend to. They weren't intentionally trying to skew these results, but still it crept in there. And so while courses in science, they'll talk about the scientific method, and some will even have steps numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, about, oh, you make the observations, you do the experiments, you know. Well, even though you can list something and call it the scientific method, that's really not how scientists do it. They don't go through and say, okay, step one, now I'm going to do step two. They kind of do them all concurrently. But it gives the impression that science is a technique, and if you follow the technique, then you're going to get the right result. But as Stephen Jay Gould was arguing in The Mismeasure of Man, even if you follow the right technique, that's not going to give you the right result. And even as Dr. Fishman had said about the biophysics literature, that those studies were being published because apparently they had followed the right technique, but they didn't get the right result. There's something else there, something very important. Even if you do everything right, even if you follow what's prescribed as a scientific method, you can still be completely wrong. And in fact, if you're creative and clever, you could be even more wrong than if you weren't so clever. There's something that's rarely expounded upon, but it's the absolute most critical aspect of doing science. And that is the mortification of bias. And so I like to say that's the power of the scientific method, is in the mortification of bias. And so part of the process is you come up with a hypothesis, you test it, you show it to your colleagues, and really the best attitude is, can you help me find my errors? Where am I making a mistake? Can you see anything wrong? And you really are looking for the best criticism that you can get. And then after that's done, then you give a talk to the whole department or open throughout the university, and hopefully somebody will notice an error there. And then after that, then you publish, and again, then you're hoping for a good criticism to find any of your errors. And so really, I came to understand that the process of science isn't so much proving a hypothesis or a theory, but it's finding the errors. It's in removing the scales from one's eyes. Because clearly, God has blessed us with incredible intellects. The technologies we're able to develop, the discoveries we're able to make, our intellects are not the problem. It's the fact that we hide the truth from ourselves because of our fallen nature and fallen will. So this really started to have an impact on me because I started to think, well, and what I started to do was actually keep a list and try to make notations of when I would assume something to be true, when it wasn't, when I'd fooled myself. You know, this seemed really important to me. And so I started to see just how all day, every day, I was just fooling myself again and again and again. And so I started to think, well, you know, and also in my biophysics research, you know, I'd find where my pet theory, I missed something because I really wanted my pet theory to be true. And so I thought, well, if I'm doing this in biophysics as well as other people, which is such a something where you wouldn't think there'd be very much bias and you could be objective, you know, what about in other areas, like moral areas? What about moral questions? You know, that's where my bias could really come into play, and there's not a very good way to check it. You know, how are you going to keep your bias in check with moral areas? So I really started to try to apply the same critique and the same self-reflection that I was learning to do in biophysics. And things really looked quite a bit different. You know, the moral choices, especially in relationships, like with women and that type of thing. And, those moral questions really looked very different once I actively tried to remove my bias and try to see the truth for what it is, not for what I wanted it to be, and not what other people were telling me, which they also wanted it to be. And so this really began to change my behavior. And I just couldn't carry on the same way, you know, sincerely. And then a friend of mine who I knew from the university, who was working on a degree in nursing, he just finished up and he said, I've got a calling to the priesthood. And I said, oh no, you don't want to do that. Because I had already known since a child that was just this monstrous hoax. And so I said, oh no, you don't want to do that. And so I started to research the church teachings. And I wanted to know actually what the church taught. Because I wanted to really disabuse him of this crazy notion of wanting to be a priest, and that the Catholic Church had something to provide other than just leading him astray. And so as I started to study the church teachings, especially the older teachings, and faith and morals and things like that, I was really taken aback because the church was teaching what I had come to understand and come to believe, trying to be an honest atheist. I was just trying to be honest with myself and not see things selfishly, not see things through biased eyes. And that's the church was teaching the same thing that I was coming to, except the church taught it so beautifully and so eloquently and so much more fully. And this was quite a surprise to me. This was quite a shock. I was not expecting that. I started to learn a little bit more and start to have philosophical discussions. He entered the seminary, and it didn't really last long because I'm sure it will come as no surprise. The formation director was an open communist and openly preying on the seminarians. And so, of course, my friend, being sincere, could not stand for that, and he had to report it to the and he had to just keep reporting higher and higher up until Rome got involved, because it just kept he was actually the one that was chastised for bringing this out. And so he left the seminary, and he had been very sincere about this calling, and so he'd given up all of his worldly possessions. He had absolutely nothing. And I said, well, you know, it's fine. You can come stay. I have an extra room in my house. You can stay here. You can continue, you know, studying at the University of St. Thomas, and continue studying theology and metaphysics and all that, and we'll have great discussions when you get back. And indeed, we did. We had some fantastic discussions. But it also led to a rekindling of my interest in the Mass, because I was starting to see there was something really important in the Church. The Church really did have something important to say, that like my professor, the paleontology professor, the Church was speaking humbly and honestly and saying things that, because they were the truth, even if we don't want to hear them. And so as I began to study more and more about the Church and start to ask about the Mass, and I had asked about the Mass when I was an altar boy. I mean, it just seemed so crucial. And so I would ask, well, what is the Mass about? What is it? And I just could never get an answer that really meant anything to me intellectually or spiritually. I mean, they would say, oh, well, it's the sacrifice of Christ, or they'd give answers, but it wasn't like they believed it, and it seemed more like they were perturbed that I would persist in trying to understand the Mass. And so I started asking those questions again. I started with my friend. We would go to morning Mass at the local Novus Ordo church, and it really didn't satisfy very much, but it was good to hear the gospel readings, and sometimes there was a decent sermon. And so I started to ask priests, started to go to philosophical talks at the Newman Center, and met some of the more conservative priests, and asked about the Mass. Look, I really want to understand the Mass. So there's something important here. Can you explain it to me? And again, something just did not, there was something that they were missing that they could not communicate, or that I was unable to understand. It just was not getting through to me. And I continued with this. And then finally my friend said, you know, I kept saying, look, I've got to understand the Mass. This is so important. And so he said, okay, here you go. And he handed me Father Stedman's Little Missal. I didn't know about the traditional Mass at that time. And I opened up this little missal, and there something clicked. I could see that there was something there. And so we started to look for traditional Masses in the area, and found an SSPX chapel, and then eventually found a traditionalist chapel. And so So we went to that, and in this little independent chapel, is a very small, little, humble chapel. But that was a moment of where I had a moment of great epiphany, because going in there and examining one's conscience, praying for humility, and then witnessing what I had already described as an atheist, trying to be an honest atheist, which is our relationship to the truth is that we crucify it. That we are ever moving closer or further, but everything, every decision that we make, every interaction that we have, is a personal reaction with the truth, or a personal interaction with the truth. And either we are going to humble ourselves before it, and it is going to provide blessings and life to us, or we're going to crucify it. And so that was the first time that it all came together, because as I watched that sacrifice, and there's no doubt, it was absolutely clear, as opposed to the Novus Ordo masses, there was a sacrifice going on there. Something was being offered. Something was being sacrificed. And that's where I saw it. Just as I had seen in many little different ways in my scientific endeavors, and I saw the truth being put up on the altar, even if the altar is a lab bench. So I saw the truth right there being offered. But then when I saw that mass and I saw the truth itself being offered, and it was so clear that all my sins, all my selfishness, put it right up there. And all the things that I tried to describe, just trying to be an honest atheist, was so beautifully presented right there in that mass, the truth crucified. And so that's how I end up being here today, because what I've seen is that in real science, in really sincere science, and in the scientists that I've met and that I've been drawn to and taken as mentors, their real goal and their real love is for the truth. And you'll hear within the scientific community a great appreciation for humility. Great appreciation for humility, because that is the key. That's the only way we can come closer to the truth, is by humility. And so unfortunately, and I'll speak some more on this tomorrow, science has really been kind of undermined and hijacked. And there's not that same sense. Now a lot of what is passing for science, and I think this audience has probably recognized to a great degree how evolution is quite anti-scientific. They're not after the facts. They've already decided what they want to be true. What's the same. That's what has drawn me to traditional Catholicism, is because it's about humility before the truth. And even though we do move closer sometimes and move away, estus veritatis, the truth is always there. It's always waiting for us. And it's never going to change. Thank you.